science writer and skeptic Vicky Hyde on the panel today with physics teacher and pilot Steve McCabe. Good afternoon to you, Vicky and Steve.
How are you?
You are also a beekeeper, are you not?
Yes, I am. Well, I was and I am again. My wife and I keep me bees for a while. And about 18 months ago, at the end of, when would it be? About 2011, at the end of the summer there, we discovered that we'd lost all our bees. And as far as we could tell, the hive had been invaded by wasps. Apparently this is a thing that can happen. End of the summer, the wasps decide that they've run out of their own food supplies for the winter. They will invade hives.
Can't the bees fight them off?
Sometimes they can. Sometimes they get overwhelmed. Obviously, our girls weren't quite up to the task that particular time. Okay. Obviously, it was a very strong wasp invasion, wasps being the evil little creatures that they are. Mm. And so we were devoid of bees for a while. And last year, we kept thinking, you know, we need to get bees. And for whatever reason, we just never quite got around to it. And we kept thinking, we need to do this. And so this year rolled around, and it's swarm season right now. I'm sure plenty of people listening have seen swarms, possibly on their own property, swarms of bees that are split off from existing hives. Queens flee with a large number of bees and take them with them. And so we got a phone call from a chap named Graham at our local beekeepers, called Franklin Beekeepers. And Graham said, there is a swarm just down the road. Would you like to go and get it?
Would you like it?
Absolutely. And we've been waiting for this phone call for ages. And finally, when it came in, you think, oh dear, that's it, we have to do this now. So we went and dug our beekeeping suits out of the bottom of the cupboard, went out to the garage, and we found a cardboard box. It's all it was, a basic cardboard box, taped up every possible aperture except the top. And we went down to the house down the road, and fortunately, it was a perfect position for a starter swarm for people like us who've never done a swarm before. It was a clump of bees about the size of a rugby ball, and it had fastened onto a rubber plant that was about, maybe 2 feet off the ground. It was really convenient, really accessible. So all you do is you place your box underneath the swarm, you grab hold of the branch, and you give the branch a good firm shake, and the entire clump of bees just falls into the box. It lands with a thud. It's a solid mass of bees. There's a few thousand bees in there. It just lands with a thump. And you wait for a couple of minutes for any stragglers to climb the way in, you give another quick shake and a few more fall in. Seal it up, drive 30 seconds back down the road, open up your hive, open it up, open up the box, dump them in. And again, same thing, the bees just fall out in a clump.
Are any bees injured in this vigorous process?
One or two did complain quite strenuously. Right. Yes, they went, ouch. But apart from that, what you have to remember in all seriousness is you cannot think of bees as individual creatures. They are a colony. And the colony itself is now safe. And individual bees will sacrifice themselves for the sake of the colony. That's why they sting themselves to death trying to protect the hive. Yeah. So we got ours back. We dumped them in. You leave the box underneath the hive overnight. And the next thing you know, the box is empty. The hive is full. And we've got bees again. So I had a quick look. Had a quick look this morning. They're nicely building row after row of comb. Virgin white comb right now. But very shortly, it's going to be dripping with honey. And it's going to be fabulous.
Do you know the Hillebillock cautionary tale on bees? Cautionary rhyme? When Mrs. Gorm, Aunt Eloise, was stung to death by savage bees, her husband, Prebendary Gorm, put on his veil and took the swarm. He's publishing a book next May on how to make beekeeping pay.
Oh, no, our bees aren't savage. They're quite sweet.
So when the wasps attack, I'm interested in the savage aspects of the story.
Right.
Do they attack in huge numbers? Because you don't see wasps in huge numbers usually, do you?
Well, from what I can gather, no, it doesn't take many. A few wasps can overwhelm the bees quite easily.
Okay.
And once, as far as I can tell, once the bees sense that they are being overwhelmed, they will swarm, they will flee.
Okay.
And so they leave behind their supplies. They take what they can, they fill little honey stomachs and fly off. And a lot of the comb will be left with honey in it. And the wasps then go, bingo, we'll take what's left.
They beat a retreat.
Steve McCabe. Thank you for that, Jim.
Vicky Hyde, your eldest boy is having an important birthday.
Probably both, actually. Yes, he's turning 21 today, which is made me feel like kind of a time warp in action, given that it was such a long time ago and such a short time ago as well. Really kind of interesting how you feel about that sort of thing. I had a phone call from him just before I came out to the studio, which is, given it's 3 a.m. in Paris, I think was quite good.
Yes, no, good on him. He's a dutiful son. So how's he celebrating?
He's having a fairly quiet time at the moment, but he's planning on having a party on Friday. In fact, his brother has organised a Skype party for all his friends back here, because he says the French can't understand his preoccupation with being 21, that it's a big deal, because they don't tend to sort of celebrate that, he says.
Don't they?
So I think he's feeling a little bit lonely in Paris because he hasn't got anybody to to pat him on the back and say, well done.
I wonder what the coming of age is in France.
Mm.
Okay. And so you've been ruminating on the swift passage of time when you have a child. Everybody talks about it.
Yes, I mean, and it's, I guess it goes along with that lovely phrase, which gets more and more real as I get older, which is, what is it, inside every old person is a young person wondering what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And that's true when you talk to older people as well. Thank you, Vicky Hyde, Steve McCabe, Clifford Bay, Peter Townsend will join us on this. So the government, as you've probably heard, has rejected this proposal to build the $525 million ferry terminal at Clifford Bay that had promised to cut transport times between the North Island and Canterbury, especially. Gerry Brownlee, who was sounding more optimistic about it not that long ago, but he says a study of the Clifford Bay's proposal's viability found the government would have had to stump up a portion of the costs to induce the private sector to invest in the construction and operation. And the conclusion has also been reached that Picton's facilities are not expected to fail or become constrained because of asset age or condition or growth in freight volumes over the next 30 years. So that is the conclusion. It obviously isn't a conclusion that everybody agrees with, but it certainly caused the champagne corks to pop in Picton. We'll talk to Peter Townsend. Just your reaction to the news. Has the government missed the boat, excuse the pun, or does this sound sensible to you?
Well, it sounds reasonable. I mean, it's very, very easy to scale up the amount of shippage, if that's the right word, going across the Cook Strait. Lay on more boats. It's eminently scalable. So I don't know necessarily that there is a need to do it. And I think what they're saying is that the development costs at Clifford Bay would be so great that it's not that there's no no ultimate benefit in doing it.
Yes.
I mean, Picton's a difficult place to get out of, from what I can gather.
Well, it's a slow place to get out of. And you could with the new ships, which are increasingly being built, unlike the ones, you know, our Potter Along ferries, you know, you could motor in to Clifford Bay, to put it crudely. But then the weather is not as good. You'd need more tugboats, but there would be more journeys. Vicky, from your point of view down there, though, the economic benefits to Christchurch and the rest of Canterbury were cited in particular because you'd dramatically shorten both the ferry trip and the entire transport trip for freight.
Well, yes,
for freight.
I mean, everybody, whether you're taking freight or people, that extra bit having to get over and into Picton can be a right pain, especially if you're running a little bit late. I guess this is the sort of development we should have really been looking at significant time ago. It doesn't surprise me that the government's decided not to do it because it was always going to be pretty expensive. But it's a shame that we can't really take a sensible approach to national infrastructure and have a time frame that's more than one election cycle.
Yeah. The question is, and we'll go to Peter Townsend in just a sec, really, but Marlborough Port, you see, there wasn't that much income. It received $7 million of income a year from the ferries, which people said made the economic rationale for a new site hard to understand. But the question, I suppose, is would you create a great economic benefit in dollar terms through faster journeys and less fuel and so on? Peter Townsend is Chief Executive of the Canterbury Employers Chamber of Commerce, kindly joining us now. Good afternoon, Peter.
Yes, good afternoon, Jim.
They've talked about Clifford Bay for a long time now, haven't they?
Years and years and years, for longer than I've been alive, I think they've been talking about Clifford Bay, but certainly more intensely over the last 5 to 10 years.
Are you happy enough? Do you think that your members will be happy enough that it's going to be Picton for at least the next 30 years?
Yeah, look, I think we can live with that. My understanding is there's been an extremely robust economic analysis done. It's taken into account everything, including the cost of doing up Picton compared to the cost of building Clifford Bay. I presume it's taken into account the fact that these ferries have to run up the Queen Charlotte Sound as opposed to running straight across Cook Strait. We're disappointed because it would shorten down the time between Christchurch and Wellington, but we will have to comply with good economic analysis, and if it doesn't stack up, it doesn't stack up.
Okay. Setting aside the cost of the actual ferry terminal itself, how much benefit would Clifford Bay at some time in the future be for businesses in Christchurch and Canterbury, do you think?
I think from memory, it cut off a couple of hours in terms of the travel time between Christchurch and Wellington, and that's really significant. And it also gave a straight run across Cook Strait, straight into the throat of the southerly, as opposed to being broached by it across Cook Strait. So it would have been a better prospect in terms of weather, is my understanding. But you can't ignore the economic analysis. My understanding is that analysis was originally due out in February this year, It's taken a long time to come to the surface, and I'm sure that's because they've been really sharpening their pencils and looking at this from every possible option. They've come to the conclusion it isn't worth doing, and although I don't have their information, I have to concede that.
Yeah, okay. Which raises another possibility, and I notice our listeners are beginning to talk about it on the text too. Straight Shipping have said that a revival of the old ferry services from Wellington to Lyttelton Port should be considered or reconsidered, because 80% of freight goes to Christchurch and beyond. And as I mentioned before, the new faster ferries that we'll be buying in the future might make it more viable. What would be your thoughts on that, Peter?
Yeah, my off the top of the head thoughts are we've got a really good shipping service that serves us through the normal coastal shipping, Pacifica Shipping. They serve Lyttelton really well and connect us with the North Island and further south. I think the days of overnight ferries for passenger travel are over, given the way the airline industry has evolved and the frequency of air travel and the cost of air travel. So I doubt whether that will be seen to be a viable proposition in terms of a ferry, direct ferry linkage, including passengers and roll-on, roll-off. I'd love to see it, but I doubt that will happen anytime soon.
Okay, so that's become, in your view, something of a romantic notion, but not entirely feasible.
Jim, we're all old enough, or at least I am, to remember holding onto streamers on the wharf at Lyttelton and then having a glass of flat beer on board and a ginger nut with our cup of tea in the morning. But I think those days are over, yeah.
All right, Peter. Peter Townsend, thank you very much. 4:19 on the panel with Steve and Vicky. And Bernard Hickey now. Good afternoon, Bernard. I think Bernard's there somewhere. I'd just like to confirm that Bernard is there. I can't hear him.
Good afternoon. I can hear you there, Jim.
Good, okay. While we're on Clifford Bay, because we want to talk to you about other things, but, you know, a long time ago, part of the problem with any Clifford Bay initiative, of course, is who would pay for it, and the government doesn't particularly want to. And if you read between the lines, you could think that it's going to be difficult to get, you know, a private entrepreneur that interested. But a long time ago, you know, thanks to people like Margaret Thatcher, we started selling off the assets and running the public-private partnerships and, you know, divesting ourselves of government involvement in infrastructural enterprise. If there's not enough freight going through Picton, maybe, but if there were, or if it would increase through Clifford Bay, you could get private entrepreneurial money to pay for it. But if the government paid for it, and this is the case, isn't it, with the National Convention Centre in Auckland as well, wouldn't we recoup the benefits? Because we're always seeming to involve the entrepreneurs or wait for the private enterprise money now. Is this the most sensible way of proceeding?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, which the investigation into Clifford Bay had a look at, and they found that you'd be spending about $525 million in today's money to build the terminal, and only about half of that would be justified by the actual returns you'd get from the freight you'd take back and forth across. And the other half would have to come from essentially a government gift. Now, you could argue that, well, if they're going to make gifts for, you know, ultra-fast broadband and maybe the Sky City Casino in the form of concessions on pokies, then why wouldn't they make a similar gift for Clifford Bay? But the government decided not to in this case. And you'd have to say that at least they'd done a proper commercial viability study.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it applies, doesn't it, to this whole question of the current asset sell-offs as well. Is the entire idea of divesting a government of cost in order to use the money for other things a good idea or a wrong idea? What's history telling us of the history of this, you know, of both asset sales, public-private partnerships and so on?
Yeah, it all depends on how you analyse the costs and the benefits. If you take a very long-term view and you make some pretty aggressive assumptions about interest rates and the returns on investment, sometimes it does make sense to invest public money in public infrastructure. And, you know, if you do the right cost-benefit analysis, you can get a decent measure. The Chinese, for example, they don't do this sort of stuff. They just say, well, we need, you know, 53 aluminium smelters, and yeah, we're going to build them right now, and they do it. And then they deal with the consequences later. Now, some might say that will get them in trouble later, but, you know, it's just a different approach to running a government. At some point, though, you have to... Everything has to wash its face, and it's probably a good idea to do the analysis before you build it rather than after.
So, Bernard, do you happen to know if they did consider things, for example, like, I guess, the public good economic value of things like cutting 2 hours travel time off everybody's transport, both freight and people and passengers, and how that could have an impact?
Yeah, I mean, they looked at the wider economic benefits of, hour and a half off freight, and of course the, the reduced fuel costs and all that sort of thing, and decided in the end only about half of the cost was justified by those benefits. Every cost-benefit analysis depends on its assumptions, and if you made some heroic or realistic assumptions, depending on who you are, about, let's say, the oil price, or how much time would be saved and how you could use that time, then maybe you could justify it. But in this case, they spent about $1 million on the viability study and decided in the end it wasn't worth it.
It seems like it's been a sober-headed analysis, not a political analysis, if you know what I mean, doesn't it? They've had a really good look.
Yeah, I mean, they put some officials in there. They spent a good year or so looking at it. And then it didn't just look at that. They also looked at the costs of upgrading the Picton terminal and decided the costs were about half what had originally been seen as the cost of upgrading the terminal. So, on the whole, they've done a serious job and come up with a decision based on some analysis, which you'd have to say is good.
Now, Bernard, you've talked about a very cold-headed analytical approach to this, and Jim, you've invoked the memory of Margaret Thatcher, which when you're talking to someone who was brought up in the north of England in the 80s is probably not a wise move. But the problem is that when we're working within the Thatcherite context, it's not simply a cold-headed numerical analysis. It was very much philosophically driven, where there was an assumption that public ownership was a bad thing and everything had to be private, regardless of what ramifications that might have. There was this philosophical underpinning of we must privatise everything. And so it's very, very difficult to know for certain when we have a government in this country right now that seems to be starting to set foot down that path. I agree, they're not going as far as Margaret did, thank the Lord, but we're certainly heading in that direction. Do we know for certain this was simply a cold-headed mathematical analysis?
You can have a look at the full document. It's on the transport.govt website, and it's a pretty significant thing. They've done a proper analysis, as far as I can tell. And you'd have to say, I mean, if the government was taking that Thatcherite approach, they would have simply said, well, let's make sure we sell the Picton terminal and hand over Clifford Bay to a private organisation. And they would have looked at the idea of a public-private partnership or even having a private organisation do it. But even for the private organisation, it appears the economics didn't stack up.
All right. That's probably tons about Clifford Bay, if you don't mind. Auckland's, I want to ask you all some questions, really. And Bernard, in particular, the issue of what a housing slump might look like in New Zealand. The Herald was reporting today that Auckland's so-called hidden gem suburbs have been identified by Westpac in its new housing report. And these suburbs are close to Auckland's fastest-selling suburbs, but are substantially cheaper. And Westpac are saying buyers can save themselves up to 8 years' worth of mortgage repayments. So you wouldn't think that Westpac are doing their absolute best to cool the property market down. But, of course, Graham Wheeler has been talking, and I noticed, Bernard, he's warned of the risks of a correction or sharp fall in house prices, which we all know was the risk that prompted the introduction of the restrictions. How are you seeing that at the moment, and what would a housing crash or correction look like right now?
Well, when you look at house prices relative to incomes, most people think we're about 20 to 30% overvalued. And when I say most people, I'm saying the OECD, the IMF and the Reserve Bank. So if house prices were to revert to what they had been in the past on average, then you'd see a 20% fall in house prices. But as we know, with so much money being printed all around the world, with interest rates in the rest of the world, close to 0% or 0%, and in New Zealand at record lows for 5 years, this has pumped lots of cash into that housing bubble. And this is one of the risks for the Reserve Bank, and it was pointed out yesterday by Graham Wheeler, that if the housing bubble was to deflate too quickly, that could actually damage the economy. So he wants to see house price inflation fall, but not necessarily house prices.
Okay, but there's no guarantee that strategy will work, is there?
No, and when we've got rising net migration, a lot of New Zealanders are coming back from the likes of Australia and Britain, often with big chunks of cash in their hand from selling a house in Australia or Britain, and often they're on strong incomes, so they can come in here and get a welcome home loan, and then gear up and pump more money into that market. That's working against the Reserve Bank. Also, these interest rates all around the world are extraordinarily low, and just in the last day or so, we've heard the European Central Bank say that it hasn't started printing money yet, but it could. And just earlier this week, it cut interest rates to 0.25%, surprising a few people. The central banks in Britain, Japan, and the United States are still printing money, and all that printed money, that 0% money, is squirting out the sides, and some of it's dribbling down here. And, of course, just a dribble from that, depending on how you measure it, $3 or $4 trillion a year, just a dribble from that is enough to help inflate property bubbles all around the world. You're seeing it in London, New York, Sydney, Melbourne, the likes of Hong Kong, and, of course, in Auckland, these international cities, where that cheap, easy, recently printed money finds its way into a real asset and pumps up the value.
Isn't there an argument, though, that higher house prices in Auckland, for example, may be a price we have to pay for the next few years while the books are balanced? Because the government seems very keen to balance those books as it rushes towards an Air New Zealand sale. So, you know, isn't there an argument that, in fact, that's the lesser of the evils?
Yeah, well, there's an interesting one for any government or Reserve Bank. They would like those house prices not to race away too much, both from an economic point of view and a political point of view. But if they burst the bubble, and I asked this question of Graham Wheeler yesterday, should the Reserve Bank, if the high LVR limits don't work, should the Reserve Bank put up interest rates purely to burst the bubble? He didn't answer the question, actually. He left it to his deputy to say that Reserve Bank didn't want to burst the bubble because that would be damaging to the financial system, but it would quite like to lean against it, which is one way of saying maybe the Reserve Bank, if this doesn't work, will have to look in a couple of years' time at putting up interest rates more than they otherwise
but
would.
Won't that send the New Zealand dollar higher against the trading partners and the Japanese housewives buy the Kiwi again and that the exporters get clobbered?
Yeah, and that's an interesting balance for the Reserve Bank to walk. How much do they care about overvalued house prices relative to the poor old exporters? And that's the problem we face with an economy which is not so much an economy, it's a housing market with bits tacked on. And for everyone, politicians, homeowners, so much is at stake. You've got to remember that our housing market is worth $700 billion. And even though the stock market is up a little bit this year, it's still only worth $60 or $70 billion. House prices are everything for the New Zealand economy. And that's why, politicians, central bank governors, homeowners, everyone cares so much about it, much more than any other investment choice.
Can I ask you a question, just a final question about the loan-to-value ratios? How feasible is it that a young couple in New Zealand could actually get a loan from an overseas bank?
Pretty much impossible.
Okay.
Unless they actually live overseas and are migrating here or have strong connections. There are some people who are doing that, borrowing in Singapore or wherever, but they're taking some exchange rate risk when they do that, and most banks are pretty reluctant to do it.
All right, Bernard Hickey from interest.co.nz, as well as his new venture, Hive News. Thank you very much, Bernard. Any concluding comments before we move on?
Yeah, I know it's a bit of a tangent, but it's something that does kind of come to mind as we're talking about this. As Bernard says, housing is everything in this country, and it's the single biggest expense that most people have every month. And I do wonder, for people like myself, I'm a teacher, I'm on a collective agreement that governs the salaries of every teacher in the country from north to south, and yet I have to pay substantially more to live in my rather modest accommodation than somebody living comparably will do very nearly anywhere else in the country, with the exception of the centre of Auckland.
Yeah.
That basically means that I am on a significantly lower take-home pay than most other teachers. Is it time, given the imbalance in the country, to consider doing what happens in London, for example, and add a loading to salaries in Auckland?
You do get to live in the city where the show never stops.
Absolutely. I wouldn't be here otherwise, would I?
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a popular move, I think.
It would be a popular move among Aucklanders.
Well, I mean, it could apply to areas like your own, Vicky Hyde, that kind of premium, for living in Auckland as opposed to living in Balclutha. couldn't it?
Yes. Didn't they used to have a tax, a stipend for British diplomats having to live in Washington because it was such a horrible, horrible place to live?
It was. It was a swampland. Before air conditioning, it's absolutely. In the summer, it is savage and brutal, and in the winter, it's bitterly cold. And they did get a hardship allowance.
Okay, so you want the Auckland stipend?
Well, the Auckland Hardship Allowance, however you choose, however you choose to spin it.
Hardship Allowance, thank you. We'll discuss it in detail some other time. Steve McCabe, Vicky Hyde on the panel. Back with them shortly. Wayne has the news headlines.